From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Death from opioid drug overdose, prescription painkillers, and heroin reached a new high in 2014. 47,000 Americans, 125 a day, and death rates in rural America, whiter America, now outpacing urban rates. That is changing the way drugs are talked about on the campaign trail in some dramatic ways. This hour on point from zero tolerance to drugs as a disease, the new tone on addiction. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Has the opioid epidemic hit you, your town? Has it changed the way you want to hear politicians talk about it? Is it changing policy, the way we treat or lock up the addicted? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Emma Roller, contributing writer for the New York Times Campaign Stops blog. You can read her article, Just Saying Yes to the Politics of Drugs, at our website, onpointradio.org. Emma Roller, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you've been watching and you've been listening. Here's just a little example. There was one time, and we'll hear it, where it was all about lock them up and throw away the key. Here's Chris Christie talking about a law school friend who died of overdose, opioid addiction. This was in New Hampshire, November 4th, concluded like this.
There but for the grace of God go I. It can happen to anyone. And so we need to start treating people in this country, not jailing them. We need to give them the tools they need to recover, because every life is precious. Every life is an individual gift from God.
Every life, an individual gift from God. Emma Roller, in the context of drug abuse, this is a new tone, and you must be seeing a lot of it.
I sure am, and it is a remarkable shift in rhetoric that we've seen on both sides of the aisle, really, but especially among the Republican field. Chris Christie told that moving story about a friend from law school who died of a Percocet overdose. We've also heard from Carly Fiorina, whose 35-year-old stepdaughter, Lorianne Fiorina, died after struggling with the demons of addiction, as Carly Fiorina says. And even Jeb Bush has opened up about his own daughter's struggle with prescription drugs. His daughter, Noelle, who actually joined him on the trail in New Hampshire last week. So this change in rhetoric is really remarkable compared to the sort of just say no, tough on crime rhetoric we saw in the 80s and 90s during the Reagan and Clinton administrations.
I mean, for anybody who lived through that, it is kind of mind-blowing. Just listen back with me for a second, Emma. Here was Jeb Bush's dad, President George H.W. Bush, talking about drugs in his national address on drug policy. This was on C-SPAN in 1989. And listen to his formula.
If you sell drugs, you will be caught. And when you're caught, you will be prosecuted. And once you're convicted, you will do time. Caught, prosecuted, punished.
Caught, prosecuted, punished. I mean, the tone is total zero tolerance. And what do we need? What do we need to address the national drug problem? Here again, President George H.W. Bush, 1989.
We need more prisons, more jails, more courts, more prosecutors. So tonight I'm requesting altogether an almost $1.5 billion increase in drug-related federal spending on law enforcement.
Emma, just let that sink in. Now we're talking about overcrowded prisons and all the rest, and this ad is out from Jeb Bush. New ad on TV, you've probably seen it, talking about his daughter Noelle's struggle with drug addiction.
Today I was at a summit dealing with this heroin epidemic, and this is a huge problem. It's not just heroin, it's drug addiction in general. And I have personal experience in this as a dad. My daughter Noelle was addicted to drugs. And today I called her to tell her that I was going to talk about her in this public setting. It's not easy to do. And she said, go do it. You know, I want to help. She was put in jail. And then she went to drug court. And it was tough. It was really hard. I can look in people's eyes and I know that they've gone through the same thing that Kaluma and I have.
Jeb Bush, his dad, lock him up, the son. All the compassion you can hear just rolling in there. Emma Roller, that is just a remarkable transformation. What is driving it?
It is really incredible to hear those clips side by side. I think it sort of stems from the hate the sin, love the sinner rhetoric that's coming out of the GOP these days. And especially when you have a loved one who has faced these struggles, and when it's affecting your community as opposed to, you know, a community you may not have interacted with much, I think it's a lot easier to empathize with people who are addicted to drugs and want to take a more compassionate tone rather than just lock them up, lock them up, lock them up.
People you may have not interacted with as much. I mean, that gets to one big change in what we're seeing with the opioid epidemic, with the rise in prescription painkillers, the heroin that's followed it. But the color of drug users has shifted and shifted dramatically, and not least in New Hampshire. That first big primary vote and key for these people. Describe that dynamic for us, Emma.
Sure. So in New Hampshire, just over the last 2 years, overdose deaths linked to opiate abuse have more than doubled. It's really a critical epidemic there. I spoke with the mayor of Manchester, New Hampshire, for my piece, and he's a Republican. He has the opportunity as a mayor in New Hampshire to speak to a lot of Republican presidential candidates, and he has really been talking up this issue because it is something that is hitting his constituents very close to home and something that, honestly, 20 years ago was probably only thought of as a problem for inner city communities and minority communities, but now it's clear that it's reaching into the suburbs, into rural communities, and that has sort of caused a eureka moment, I think, for some of these candidates.
We've got a bit of the Chris Christie story, his friend. I mean, everybody's telling stories about how close it's come to them. Here's Chris Christie.
He lost his right to see his girls. He lost his license to practice law. He lost his driver's license. A year and a half ago on a Sunday morning, Mary Pat and I got the call that we've been dreading forever, that they found him dead in a motel room with an empty bottle of Percocet and an empty quart of vodka, 52 years old.
A close friend of Chris Christie, he'd gone to law school with him. Everybody seems to be testifying now, Emma Roller, about how it's come so close to me. It's come so close to me, and therefore my compassion is high.
Right, and I think that does affect things. All politics is personal, as the saying goes. And that doesn't excuse people for, you know, maybe thinking of drug users in the past as maybe in a less humane way, per se. But I think it is remarkable the change in rhetoric that we're seeing both in Congress and on the campaign trail in terms of criminal justice reform and how we should approach this as a public health issue, not a necessarily a punitive issue.
I mean, you could say it's just drama. It's just theater trying to appeal to families and people who have been hit by this. But of course, the candidates themselves have been hit by it. Here's Carly Fiorina. She talks often and openly about losing her stepdaughter, Lori Ann, to drug and alcohol abuse. This is a bit from the second GOP debate back in September.
My husband, Frank, and I buried a child to drug addiction. So we must invest more in the treatment of drugs.
What does that mean about the old lock them up and throw away the key approach? Here was Fiorina again in that debate.
Two-thirds of the people in our prisons are there for nonviolent offenses, mostly drug-related. It's clearly not working.
And here, Hillary Clinton, just this last Sunday in the Democratic debate, talking about the opioid epidemic.
We have to move away from treating the use of drugs as a crime and instead move it to where it belongs, as a health issue. And we need to divert more people from the criminal justice system into drug courts, into treatment and recovery.
And that's time.
So this is the kind of approach that we should take.
Emma Roller, it's just incredible how the tenor has changed as the pattern of use, the demographics of use have changed. Do we see proposals to really change American policy on this, or is it already changed and they're racing to catch up?
Right. And I'd just like to note that this is a change in rhetoric that we've seen on both sides. You had that remarkable clip from George H.W. Bush, but during Bill Clinton's own time in office, he signed the 1994 crime bill, which imposed three strikes rules.
Yeah.
And during his administration, he saw the prison population rise 60%. And now Hillary Clinton has sort of had to reckon with that history. And what they have said is that times have changed. The crime rate is down, so they have to approach it differently. But the fact is that at the end of the day, you're still approaching nonviolent offenders in really polar opposite ways.
Do you see policy changes, either already enacted or coming, that put teeth, that make real a change in policy, not just rhetoric around drug use?
Right. So the place to be looking right now is on the campaign trail, and Jeb Bush and Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton have all put out sort of nuanced proposals. Jeb Bush has called for increasing access to drug courts, which, as he said, his own daughter went to drug court. And what drug courts do is they allow someone who has been convicted of drug use to go through a mental health treatment program rather than spending time in jail. So he wants to increase access to those. He also wants to roll back some mandatory minimums. He didn't say all, but there is also a movement in Congress to roll back some of those mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. But that is really an interesting intra-party fight among congressional Republicans.
It's in the Senate now. Paul Ryan's been very much for this reform. Mitch McConnell teetering because you've still got Republicans who are very hard line on this and don't want to see it, still want the crime and punishment approach to this. But on the campaign trail, it's just remarkable. Are voters jawboning them into this change? Are they just reading it in the polls, or are they being confronted by people on the trail saying, don't lock up my kids, they've got a problem, help me treat them?
Well, I think in town halls, numerous town halls, and Donald Trump even noted this one day, that you can't go to New Hampshire and hold a campaign event without someone standing up. And usually it's a mother or a father standing up and saying, I lost my kid to heroin abuse or to prescription painkiller abuse. And it's really hard. I don't think it's necessarily that they are directly challenging them and saying, don't lock up my kids, but just being able to see these drug users as real people and not just statistics as someone to be, you know, locked up and taken out of society so we don't have to deal with them anymore.
Emma, we're going to get this perspective, but if you're an African-American listening to this change in tone after all the years when so many millions locked up and locked up for a long time on drug use, it must just be make your head spin.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the country's changing tone on drug use. On the 2016 campaign trail and beyond, as opioid use and more hits a wider swath of America, a whiter swath of America. You can join us this hour. Have you heard 2016 candidates talk tearfully, sympathetically about those close to them who have struggled with drug abuse? Does it make the candidates feel more real to you, more human? Do you feel like you're being played? And what is the right approach to our opioid drug crisis and more? Punishment or compassion? Jail time or treatment? Emma Rahler is with us, contributing writer at the New York Times Campaign Stops blog. She's paid a lot of attention to all the talk about drug addiction, drug abuse, and very sympathetic talk out there. A notable feature of this year's campaign. This was Jeb Bush describing when he first realized the extent of the drug addiction issue in first primary vote in the state after the caucuses in Iowa, New Hampshire.
It hit me like a brick wall, where at the hotel that we normally stay in, two people had loved ones that died of an overdose in the last 6 months. And I met two other people that had a similar experience in that same day.
Walk into New Hampshire, and there it is. It's all over. But not just there. All over the country. This was just last month, Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, saying in debate, addiction is a disease, not a crime. And here he had stern words, not for drug abusers, but for the medical community.
We have got to tell the medical profession and doctors who are prescribing opiates and the pharmaceutical industry that they have got to start getting their act together. We cannot have this huge number of opiates out there throughout this country where young people are taking them, getting hooked, and then going to heroin.
And it's right across the spectrum, sort of. Last fall, here was Ted Cruz talking with CNN's Jake Tapper. Cruz talked about his sister, Miriam, and her lifelong struggle with drugs and alcohol here, recounting a time, everybody's doing confessional these days on this, when he and his father went to a crack house to find Ted Cruz's sister and tried to convince her to seek treatment, if only for the sake of her young son. Here's Ted Cruz.
We pulled her out. We went to a Denny's and spent about 4 hours trying to talk to her, saying, Miriam, what are you doing? And she was just angry. She wouldn't change. And you can't, with an addict, you can't make them change if they're unwilling to get treatment, if they're unwilling to walk a different path.
Ted Cruz still kind of tough on this. We'll look at that. Emma Rahler, it's almost as though the candidates are competing for who can tell the most tear-jerking story about drug addiction in their family, in their circle.
Right. And I think in a lot of these cases, it's merited because they have had to undergo these really personal, painful experiences. But it is remarkable to me that they are opening up more about this than, say, someone during the Reagan era would want to admit to having a family member addicted to drugs during the Just Say No era. Some people have called this the gentrification of addiction. And you mentioned this earlier, how it's spreading into more white communities, and that has maybe contributed to its rising as an issue to national prominence. Between 2002 and 2014, overdose deaths in rural areas overtook those in large metropolitan areas. And among young white adults, drug overdoses are reaching almost AIDS epidemic levels of proportions in terms of rising death rates. Between 1999 and 2014, the overdose death rate for white men and women aged 25 to 34 went up 5 times. So this is clearly an issue that has become really hitting home to younger white Americans, rural Americans, suburban Americans, who maybe never even conceived of this issue in such personal terms before it really started to affect their neighbors and their families.
And now these candidates looking for votes, of course. Your paper running last fall, a big headline in Heroin Crisis, the opioid at the illegal end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. White families seek gentler war on drugs. Is that what they're responding to? They're afraid they'll lose votes if they're too hard because this is hitting lots of families, including white families now.
Right. I'm not sure if it's a cynical political calculation so much as when you listen to that Jeb Bush quote that you just played back, it really sounds like he had a eureka moment, like, oh, it's not mm-hmm. just my daughter. It's not just criminals living in inner cities. It's normal people. And ultimately, they're all normal people, probably with very mundane stories about getting injured at work and getting prescribed painkillers and getting addicted that way and using heroin from there. It's not like this secretive, terrible thing that's happening. It's a very mundane epidemic, but it's a real epidemic that candidates need to be addressing.
Emma Roller, I'm so glad you're with us. You've been following all this on the campaign trail, and it's quite striking. I want to dig on in here from a couple of angles, if I may. Please stand by there in Washington. With us now from NPR station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, is Josiah Jody Rich, professor of medicine and epidemiology at Brown University's Warren Alpert Medical School, attending physician at the Miriam Hospital. His expertise is in infectious diseases and addiction. Jody Rich, it's good to have you back on Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with me in the studio is Leah Wright-Rigger, professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Leah Wright-Rigger, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Jody, you're on the front lines of this. There's a lot of really sympathetic talk on the campaign trail. Do you see it translating into a change in how we actually deal with people who are suffering from drug addiction, drug abuse?
Tom, I hope so. A number of important points have already been covered. The switch from, lock them up to more compassion. And I think part of the issue is compassion, but part of it is that lock them up, zero tolerance approach has just failed. Our war on drugs has failed. This is not something that we can lock our way out of. We have to treat people, and treatment is highly effective. Another point that was brought up is the politicians willing to speak on this. And of course, we have a nonviolent former drug user in the White House now. President Obama mentioned even before he ran for president that he was had used drugs.
Had smoked marijuana as a young man, yep.
And cocaine.
Hmm.
So, but I think what's really, and the third issue is the suburban epidemic. But addiction in suburban populations, including fatal addiction in suburban populations, is nothing new. We have had addiction to alcohol and nicotine, and that's killing many people, many more people. But what's really new right now is the opioids. And Bernie Sanders is absolutely right. It's the physicians that have prescribed opiates that have really led to this epidemic.
The irony of the change in tone as the color of use and abuse has changed, not lost even on the candidates. Here was just earlier this month, Jody, Leah. This was John Kasich at the New Hampshire Forum on Addiction, talking about how race has played into our response to drug abuse.
This disease knows no bounds, knows no income, knows no neighborhood. It's everywhere. And sometimes I wonder how African Americans must have felt when drugs were awash in their community and nobody watched. Now it's in our communities. And now all of a sudden we've got forums and God bless us. But think about the struggles that other people had.
Leah Wright Regeer, you've been watching all this. You've been listening. Bring us an African-American perspective if you'd be good enough. It must be galling at times. Who wouldn't be for compassion, I guess? Who wouldn't be for effective treatment? But that was not the main message from our political leaders for decades.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think for many people watching this and watching this develop, there's a sense of hope. There's definitely a sense of hope, right, that things could change, that policies could change. The criminal justice reform and the mass incarceration bipartisan legislation that's currently pending kind of in the Senate right now and in Congress has really gotten, I think, African-Americans hopeful about a lot of these things. But then there's a level of cynicism as well, an incredible level of cynicism. I mean, African-Americans have been saying this for decades, for generations.
Help us. My son's in trouble. I need help. My daughter's in trouble. I'm in trouble. I need help.
Right. And I think also they've been pointing out the disproportionate way in which African-Americans have been targeted by many of these punitive crime policies, these tough on crime policies.
Tougher on crack than on cocaine and so on.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the important thing, you know, if we look at history too, in the 1970s, about white and black heroin users were about equal. But the people who were disproportionately targeted were black people. And so when we thought about drugs and when we thought about, you know, the drug dealer or the drug user, even though this wasn't necessarily true, it became racialized. It became a way of talking about dangerous black people, black and brown people. Donald Trump even played into this earlier in the campaign season when he talked about Latino drug dealers and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think as we start to see it shift, there's this real cynicism where people are saying, okay, now that it's reached epidemic levels amongst white suburban and rural people, now we're saying it's a problem, and now we're saying that we need to change. When in fact, for years, people have been saying this, and I think that's a tough pill to swallow.
Of course, the real national change hasn't happened yet. You've still got resistance in the Senate. Mitch McConnell trying to get on board with this. President Obama in the State of the Union address last week talked about this being something that Republicans and Democrats could work on together. But here's Senator Jeff Sessions out of Alabama resisting, other Republicans as well, saying in terms of cutting back on mandatory minimums and sentencing, I don't think it's a healthy thing to do. This is the Alabama senator. If we lay off drug prosecutions, we're going to see even more murders and crimes, deaths and destruction. I think we need to slow down, be careful about this, and by that he means reform. Let's go to our listeners, Raymond in Walterboro, South Carolina. Raymond, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. First off, Tom, I would once again like to say thank you to you very much. You always are very thoughtful in the topics and subjects that you boast concerning the African-American community, and in fact, we would like to adopt you. Now, that being said,
you're very kind, and I'm available.
No, I mean you're always on point. I don't know why they don't have you moderating these presidential whatever's going on.
What do you think about this issue, anyway, Raymond?
My thing is chiefly, you know, yeah, I grew up with this in my communities. I watched it flourish, and I watched it eat up generations, not just a generation, but generations. Never any concern. It always seems like once this once it reached past the urban population, now we've got to do something. You may see 2,000 black kids die in a year on the drugs. No movement. One white child, y'all got to move heaven and earth, and it is just frustrating. I mean, to no end. And then they make these tokens speeches, okay, all of them, probably with the exception of Bernie Sanders, you know. I'm an African-American, you know. I cannot see myself supporting Hillary Clinton, and I'm not giving a plug to her. I don't mean it like that. But, you know, it seems like they're pandering right now, all of them.
Raymond, may I ask you, I get that. I get that, and it may feel galling in a way after all those years where it was just lock them up. But would you welcome a change of policy that was more treatment-oriented? Might this end up being a net good, even though that might look like galling history to you?
Yes, of course. Everything, you know, I have something personal invested in this, which I'd rather not speak about, but, you know, anything, and that is my point. It seems as if we're waiting for crumbs to drop again. You know why everybody else is sitting at the table eating a big meal? We're being brushed the crumbs again. You know, at the end of the day, here come the crumbs again. And I would like to say, with as much cynicism as I can, cynicism and sarcasm as I can muster, I do thank your guest for conceding that we are all ordinary people. But I thank you again,
Amen.
Tom, and you have a nice day.
You too. Raymond, you've got a rich life, however cynical you may feel at the moment on this subject, and I appreciate your call. I want to hold that sense of what the heck. We waited a long time, and it was different before, until it hit the white community, and maybe go to that community as well. Stand by, Raymond. Tom in Syracuse, New York. Tom, you're on.
Yeah, I just wanted to offer my perspective. I've seen it. Geez, I'm a opiate addict, and I've been using for about 14 years, but 8 of those years I've been on methadone and clean. And it all started with me basically getting injured at work and starting with hydrocodones. And then from there, you got to have them every day just to function and work. And it gets to a point where actually, you don't even care about the high anymore. You just don't want to get sick. So then the time comes that somebody offers you heroin.
Yep. What do you see when you go to the methadone clinic now, Tom? What do you see there?
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, the waiting list is unreal right now. They just expanded, so there's a lot more people. And it's every color, every race. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. Once you do it, it grabs you, and it's over with.
Tom, I appreciate your firsthand witness there as well. Emma, you cover politics. As you listen to these first calls come in, I guess you can hear right away why a politician would think, hey, I better respond.
Right. And to speak specifically to Raymond, the first caller, I think black voters have every right to be cynical about this, to be frank. Because, frankly, politicians have brushed them under the rug over the past 20 years and have ignored the very real family-destroying properties of drug addiction. And it's not just like an insidious crime, like I said, although drug dealers should obviously be punished in some way. But nonviolent drug offenders and the ones who have been punished have been disproportionately black. And I think that it's going to be something to really grapple with. You cannot really divorce the war on drugs from race. And I think that, you know, in addressing one, we have to address the other. And that's something that candidates, I think, have been leaving out in their rhetoric about this new drug epidemic.
Leah, there was a racial element to the war on drugs going all the way back to the Nixon era and maybe before. Do you think we can disentangle these now that maybe a white view of this is changing as they've got more skin in the game? Sadly, can we disentangle this and change policy, or is it still caught up in racial politics?
So I do. I think the answer is yes to both, right? We can absolutely disentangle this if people are serious about addressing the issue and addressing policy and program changes. But we also have to address race. Race has to be brought into it. And I think, too, one of the frustrating things for African Americans in particular has been that generally policy and procedure has only responded when African Americans have called for punitive measures. Now, when punitive measures have been called for, it's kind of a last resort type thing, because as the first caller mentioned, these communities have been ravaged in different ways. But it seems like the only thing that politics responds to is this idea that black people need to be punished. So now that there is an effort to kind of push for rehabilitation, I think it's necessary for us to recommend race. And I think one of the things that you're going to see is black voters really calling people on what are your policies and how are they going to affect us.
Thank you. This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom with a quick heads up for you. Be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the country's changing tone on drug abuse, especially on the campaign trail, as opioid use and more has really hit in white America. Emma Roller is with us from the New York Times. Dr. Josiah Jody Rich from Brown University's Warren Alpert Medical School is here. Leah Wright-Reger from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is it time now to treat drug use as a disease rather than a crime? Where was that attitude in the time of crack when our prisons filled with African Americans? You hear it all over the campaign trail. President George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., very tough. You heard him earlier. Lock him up, throw away the key. Here was Jeb Bush at the Addiction Policy Forum in New Hampshire earlier this month talking about we have to become a second chance nation.
We need to be a second chance nation. We need to recognize that restoring people's chance to be able to live a life of purpose and meaning doesn't just deal with the illness of drug addiction. It also deals with giving them a chance to get a job and to do the other things. And drug courts provide that opportunity.
Drug courts where it's not just prison time. It's much, much more than that. Hillary Clinton as well in New Hampshire. Big, important vote for everybody here. Overwhelmingly white state. And here she is being thanked by people at a forum at a discussion in Keene, New Hampshire on drug abuse. Marty Bolden, long time in recovery, thanked Hillary Clinton for bringing the issue such prominence.
Thank you for bringing up this conversation at this level, because a voice like yours can make it safe for people like me and Sandy and Polly and hundreds of other people in this audience to speak out loud.
It wasn't safe for a long time, and a lot of people know that. Will the policy really change now? We'll see. Emma, Jody, Leah, lots of response online. Here's Janine saying, thank you. Black families have been absolutely destroyed by the so-called war on drugs. The change in tone and discourse on drug abuse, since it has more visibly hit the white middle class, is infuriating. This is how racism works, Janine writes to us. Suddenly, these are good people who need our help versus criminals who need to be eliminated from society. Maybe there's a net good effect, though, despite that irony. Let's get a few callers right here. Austin, Texas, Carol's calling. Hi, Carol, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Real bottom line, prisons are profitable. Mental health facilities, treatment centers are not. We're making money from the prisons.
You think? I mean, I'm not.
Well, the government is.
Well, the government or the corporations that it's contracting to do the business. Wow. I don't know. Leah, are you as cynical as that? Does it boil down to who makes money off the, in yet another way, off illicit drugs?
I mean, there absolutely is a, you know, prison for profit system. But I think what's relevant is that there are increasingly various factions within different political parties that see prison as a blight on the nation. Now, the question that I have, though, is that, you know, Jeb Bush said in that remarkable clip that and Hillary Clinton has also said this as well, right, that we're a second chance nation. And so the question I have is a second chance nation for whom? Right. And so who gets to, you know, who gets second chances? And I think part of the problem, I think part of the cynicism here, too, is that even as we're working on some of these criminal justice reforms, in particular around nonviolent drug offenses, African-Americans are still being disproportionately targeted for the very things that we say we're being much more careful about. So there are other policies that stretch out beyond, say, just kind of nonviolent drug offenses that include things like racial profiling, sentencing. Right, picking people up from the street. All of those things go into...
Never mind, right? Economic development and all the rest. I mean, part of what's driven so many whites down this path has been an economy that for them, too, now has become really hard to navigate. Life's become tougher.
Exactly. And so I think some of the other things that, you know, we have to talk about in this conversation, and, you know, I think of all the candidates, Bernie Sanders is probably the one who has veered most into this. But we have to also talk about what effect has the war on drugs, the prison population, the prison industrial complex, things like that. What have they had on these communities? So it's not enough to just say that we're going to change the policies, which is a start. But instead, what is the legacy of this and how are we going to begin to address the legacy of this and its connection to race and class?
David in New Orleans, thanks for calling, David. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. First, just in reference to the outrage among the Black community, I have to say that, you know, as a white member of the community, I'm also outraged that there's been so much more prosecution and racist enforcement of previous strong laws. But I do have to say it is heartening to hear an empathetic change in both parties right now is regarding this issue. And I think, you know, no matter how wrong we may be, the only way forward is good legislation, good policy. But as far as this empathy from the Republican Party, what gets me really infuriated is not so much that they waited to react until their own community was under assault, but the fact that nobody has acknowledged how they even cause these problems. I mean, number one, marijuana has been a Schedule I drug for since the 70s, and that means it has no medical benefits, even though there's never been any overdoses ever associated with it, and it probably treats pain better than opioids. You have a four big pharma lobbying group that they take massive amounts of money from, and none of these people are being held accountable for their overprescriptions of drugs. And failed war in Afghanistan meant that there is opium bumper crops year after year, meaning that now when people lose their opioid prescriptions, they can get cheap heroin on the street.
There's a lot of reasons
I think these politicians have caused these problems. And like I said, Bernie Sanders is probably the best candidate to holistically solve all of these issues.
David, we've got it. Emma Roller, there was a time when Ronald Reagan talked a lot about the war on drugs and Just Say No, still a hero in Republican circles, but are Republican candidates echoing Reagan on drugs in this campaign?
Right. So that's sort of the cognitive dissonance that's going on here, because Republican candidates at every turn will try to compare themselves to Ronald Reagan and his legacy. But this is maybe the only area where, not vocally, but implicitly, candidates are straying from Reagan's Just Say No agenda. What I would like to see is some of those Republican candidates, John Kasich sort of hinted at it in the clip you played earlier, that the havoc that was wrought by the war on drugs that was waged during the Reagan era and the Nixon era and George H.W. Bush's vice presidency. As the caller mentioned, there are some insanely outdated federal policies toward drugs, that marijuana is still classified as a Schedule I drug, meaning it has zero medical benefits and is the most dangerous drug along the lines of heroin. Meanwhile, prescription painkillers and sedatives, which accounted for more than 25,000 overdose deaths in 2014, are Schedule II, Schedule III, Schedule IV. Some of them are even classified as having a low risk of addiction, which, as we're seeing today, is just simply not true.
Is that the Big Pharma's finger on the scales, Jody Rich?
Certainly, Big Pharma has a lot to do with it. They sold the medical community a bill of goods and kind of brought us along. And
on pain relief and opioids, you mean?
Exactly. And that's really what's driven this epidemic. But they were insidious in how they approached the medical community. There's also regulatory issues. The whole focus on chronic pain. And taking a step back in history, you know, we've had a bit of a pendulum swing on our relationship to opiates. In the Civil War, we used a lot of opiates, and tens of thousands of soldiers came home with soldier's disease because we didn't have much in the battlefield, and we were sawing people's legs off. But we had morphine and opium, and tens of thousands of soldiers came back with soldier's disease, which was opioid dependence. And then in the early 1900s, physicians were shut down from prescribing opiates, and really they were jailed and really swung the pendulum the other direction. And it wasn't until it became so strikingly obvious that end of life, you know, cancer pain was not being effectively treated because of fear of physicians of being in trouble for prescribing opioids, that the pendulum began to swing back. And then along with that end-of-life cancer pain came this chronic pain, which is poorly defined and quite widespread. So we were told we should use opioids for chronic pain and rewarded for that.
Pretty soon people are getting more than they need and ending up hooked on it. But pain is still out there as well. Frank in Akron, Ohio. Frank, you're on the air.
How are you today?
Hi. Good, Frank. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm hearing all this stuff about the addicts and that, but I'm in pain 24/7, and the government's got my doctors and all doctors so afraid they're cutting back my pain medication. And they're doing it to all the other people that are in definite pain. And I just want to know, you know, I hear about all this stuff, the overdose and that, but, you know, who talks for us?
Jody Rich, speak for Frank. He's in pain, and he's afraid that we'll overreach in the other direction here, cut him off from what he needs.
There's no question that that pendulum is swinging back in the other direction. And, you know, the best treatment for pain is a comprehensive assessment using physical therapy, acupuncture, acupressure, psychotherapy, and prescription opioids have a role in that.
Who's going to pay for that full bouquet? We're much more likely, aren't we, just to toss pills?
Exactly. When you're sitting there in clinic and the patient says, I want this pill, I need this pill, my cousin gets this, my neighbor gets this, you know, give me this pill. And the waiting room was full of people saying, you know, just doc, just give them the pill and get moving. And, you know, we need to get seen. And then the administrator says, hurry up, doc. We got patients to process. A lot of pressure on the doctors to prescribe Frank's opioids.
This is going to be tricky. Frank, good luck to you. Bob in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Bob, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that even under the Democratic administration of President Obama, the recently appointed new director of the Deep Drug Enforcement Agency, in a speech shortly after his appointment, said that he wasn't sure if heroin was a bigger problem than marijuana. And then a few days later, obviously under pressure, he came out and said that, yes, he guessed heroin. He wasn't certain, but he guessed heroin was a bigger problem than marijuana was, but that we still needed to be vigilant. I guess my concern is the diversion of vitally needed resources through the Drug Enforcement Agency to fight against heroin and its problems are being utilized for the easy way out to arrest high school kids, college kids for minor pot possession. And, you know, Drug Enforcement Agency gets off, they get their numbers.
Yeah.
Money gets spent to their budget, and it's both parties.
Bob, I appreciate you raising that. I mean, Leah Wright-Rigger, how do we settle the boat here and get on the right track? Policy is difficult. Democracy is messy. You can swing from one extreme to the other and miss the sort of perfect golden mean here. You hear the concern Bob raises. How do we get this centered in a way that's realistic, funded accurately, sort of line up the rhetoric with what's needed for real solutions? Do you sense that emerging from this campaign season?
So here's the thing. We're in a really remarkable moment because there's bipartisan consensus around issues on mass incarceration, among reforming drug laws, mm-hmm. and things like that.
We'll see what the Senate does. Mitch McConnell pausing right now.
It's a very fragile bipartisan consensus and mm-hmm. can fall apart at any moment. That being said, it's remarkable because we haven't been here before.
Mm-hmm.
And because tough on crime and tough on drug rhetoric was so much a part of what our country was and what our nation was, at least on the political within the two-party political system. So right now, I think that voters actually have in particular black voters, and when we think about the Democratic Party and the role that black voters play in the Democratic Party, they have clout. They made the difference in the 2012 mm-hmm. election. And right now, I think the Democratic Party, in particular Hillary Clinton, knows that she has to win over black voters. She has to get black voters on her side. And Bernie Sanders has been cutting into that. So one of the ways in which I think we can begin to push is for people on the ground, for voters to say, we want to see your platforms. We want to see your policies. We want to know what you would do on issues like drug reform and drug policy. What would you do if you were in the White House? Mm-hmm. And I think that actually matters. Race is playing, not just in terms of drug policy, but race has become a central part of the 2016 presidential election.
Emma, not everybody's holding hands on this. I mean, Ted Cruz in particular, he may have talked about his sister in a crack house, but there's a fear that he could turn on Republicans who adopt a different policy here. He has warned that this bill pending in the Senate could release violent criminals into the streets. Where does Cruz stand? Is it clear?
Right. So Cruz is sort of a fascinating example here. He was the Solicitor General in Texas, where he gained this sort of tough on crime reputation. But then again, there's this sort of libertarian streak in the Republican Party, as we've seen with people like Senator Rand Paul, people who are for criminal justice reform, who think we are over-policing minority communities and all communities. So Ted Cruz is sort of in a sticky spot here. Especially with this new bill that's up in the Senate that would roll back mandatory minimums. And I think he's, you know, honestly got a tough line to walk. And especially one example of that is that his Senate partner from Texas, who's another Republican, Senator John Cornyn, mm-hmm. has been on the forefront of criminal justice reform in the Senate. And that contrast really just speaks to how far this issue has come in the Republican Party, and yet how far it still has to go for them to reach consensus.
Jody, you're closest to the front lines here. We just got half a minute, but are we closer now to an opportunity to get this right? Maybe to take some race out of it, all race out of it, look at it more clear-eyed way, and get a better national policy. Do you feel like we're closer, Jody?
I think we're moving closer. I think the fundamental question about mass incarceration is, what are we getting for our money? And given that it's the war on drugs, we are not getting the results we want by the existing policies. So we need to change them. We need to look at outcomes and reverse this overdose epidemic.
Well, it's certainly an extraordinary moment, given American history on this, as Leah says. We will watch how it plays out. I hope we can listen to the candidates with a more informed ear, thanks to all of you. Leah Wright-Regur at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thanks for having me.
Author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Dr. Josiah Jody Rich at the Warren Alpert Medical School at Brown University. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you, Tom.
And Emma Roller at the New York Times, your reporting's terrific. Thank you for joining us today, Emma.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Tom.
This is On Point.
Let's face it, when have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, the popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel Southern ladies, our family became an old West town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.